I'm going to be talking about the humanities and deep learning. And when I say deep learning, I have a couple ideas in mind. I have, of course, deep learning as this idea of automated pattern recognition. This is the stuff we talk about in AI all the time. But I also have this idea in mind, where you have a person who climbs into a cave, has a candle, and reads manuscripts from many, many, many centuries earlier in many, many different kinds of languages. Deep human learning. The point that I want to make with this wonderful double entendre that we have from deep learning, this word that has a couple different meanings, is that the business of the humanities and the business of business can be put into a really useful juxtaposition using an old literary figure, that of chiasmus. Fair is foul and foul is fair, say the witches in Act One of Scene One of Macbeth. Fair is fair and foul is foul until Shakespeare puts them in juxtaposition, puts them into this ABBA pattern, and I'm not talking about the rock band, right? So that we can see the words differently. They ring differently. So when new perspectives are needed, like is arguably the case now, we can use these kinds of patterns to think about what we're doing in the humanities, why humanities departments are dying for lack of a good business model, and the lives of so many around the world are struggling for a want that the humanities can provide. We can juxtapose them and see what the other might be. What the poet William Carlos Williams said about poems and the news can be said of many of the goods and services businesses provide. It's difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. And at the same time, we as humanists are sort of dying for lack of a powerful value proposition, as it's called in the language of business, that ensures the humanities in a world where so many parents and students don't know what we do or how we help ensure their children's future and enrich their lives. Deep learning in the humanities provides a mechanism for exploring what can be learned from this kind of juxtaposition. And as I get going here, I want to really make it clear that I'm not suggesting business people must become humanists or that humanists must become business people. What I aim to suggest is that there are cases that allow us to look at the humanities through the lens of business and business through the lens of the humanities, and that by examining these cases, we're presented with opportunities to see historical realities and future possibilities that we couldn't see before. Poets can be publishers and publishers poets. Humanists can be business people and business people humanists. They don't have to be, but they can be, which presents really just, from my perspective, phenomenal opportunities. Deep learning in the humanities, as I'm going to suggest, can serve humanistic ends, and the ends it serves in the humanities can also present really tremendous business opportunities. I have time for just, like I said, a couple key anecdotes, but I hope they'll make my case, and if you have questions, that you'll come find me. You know where I am. All right, so poets as publishers and publishers as poets. A lot of my research focuses on early 20th century Korea, and I look at what I think of as the secret public lives of poems. What does that mean? When we read a poem, we can read it for what it linguistically means, but we could also read it for how it was made, who printed it, how much did the book cost, who bought it, who put marks in the margins and things like this. And when we collect this information, at least for the early part of the 20th century, when the world was just totally changing, poets were doing things that they'd never done before, like writing Korean as opposed to classical Chinese. When you look at the people who are most famous in this canon, they were all publishing their own books of poems. They were publishers and poets. They were both at the same time. They were deeply engaged in the business of making poetry. Why does this matter to us as humanists and how we read? Because if you love this poem like I do, and you're looking at this poet who you know was maniacal about telling the printers, print it just right, don't even take out my commas, and you're reading down the page, because that's the way you read it, down, right, and across, and you notice the last line falls like the flowers that it describes, you think, oh my God, who did that? Was it the poet? Or was it the publisher? Wait, the poet and the publisher are the same people. Was it maybe the printer? And how do we think about the printer in this whole scenario? And then you can do a deep dive into understanding what the print shop looked like, where, how it was connected to other print shops. And yes, business students, you can start reading balance sheets from the 1920s in Korea to know what assets were held by the companies. You can learn who was the printer, and that he was in trouble with the Japanese all the time, that he was short and had a mustache and had light skin. You can learn all of these things as you dive in to understand poets as publishers and publishers as poets. And now my own sort of anecdote. Humanist is business person, and business person is humanist. Some of the work that I've been doing over the last, say, 5-10 years. Digital representation is a huge part of how we might think about the secret public lives of poems and other kinds of literature. When we're transcribing things that look like this, that have been printed at some particular point in lots of different versions, into a single version that appears on a screen like this, when we're thinking about how this works, we have to take into account how computers work. And computers can't read like we read. They just can crunch numbers. So you have to give every letter of every writing script, every script, a number so that the computer can crunch it. And how does that work? And how does it fail? All of this means that how we represent the historical record is being influenced profoundly by how we're digitizing things and the kinds of technology that's behind it. We can think about representation in a huge variety of ways. The world's libraries hold mostly German and French and Spanish texts. Other languages are not nearly as well represented. We could also think about how writing systems are enabled in computers. This is something called Unicode. There's something called Unicode, which makes it so computers can display scripts so we can read them. Everyone argues about these numbers, but there's in the neighborhood of a little less than 300 historical written scripts. We only have 159 of them encoded, which means only 159 of them can be displayed in computers. That's a huge portion of our historical record that's just gone. Well, not gone, not available to us in digital forms. And this has deep and profound effects on the kinds of research and the kinds of things that we can think and do. This is old research now. From more than a decade ago, Google and some scholars from Harvard scanned a bunch of books, did this stuff called OCR, transcribed a huge number of texts, and they found these enormous patterns, patterns in these enormous numbers of books, 5 million I think it was. And they could pull out things like when words seemed to be censored, like the word Tiananmen, right around the time of the Tiananmen uprising. Notice how that word in English goes way up, and the Chinese word doesn't go up very much, suggesting censorship. If I try to do something very, very similar using Korean, even today, and Korean is not at all an endangered language, there's millions of people speaking it, it's well digitized, but if I try to do this today, there's no record, there's no Korean. That analysis, even though we have a very similar kind of event in 1980, just 9 years before Tiananmen, very similar kind of event in Korea, but there's no way to tell if the words have been censored, only because we don't have the data, because things haven't been OCR'd, haven't been digitized. OCR is this technique of basically transcribing, automatically transcribing different kinds of texts. And for the last about 6 or 7 years, deep learning has been deeply involved in the kinds of things that we can transcribe using these OCR technologies. And it matters for us as humanists because we want to read this stuff and we want to have digital copies of this stuff. And it works pretty good for Chinese. It works terribly for my Korean poems. My Korean poems just doesn't work. It's just absolutely awful. And if I have a manuscript like this, forget about it. It written in handwritten in Korean, Google just crunches on it and never gives me an answer. What we see is that things like OCR are representational infrastructure, and they're being powered by AI. And we get images like this, or what we get as a sort of our sense of the historical record is something that's like this picture. It's wonderfully evocative. It suggests diversity. But when we dig into it a little bit, we have really fraught categories of sort of gender and ethnicity and race suggesting a whole human face. And the way that OCR and AI and things like this are working these days, we're getting a very sort of problematic sense of the historical record on really sort of fraught notions of language and script that just don't work very well. So what does a frustrated humanist do? Well, you buy a really good technologist, a really good coder, a couple cups of coffee, and become his friend, and you start working on solving this problem. So with my colleague and friend, Sang-hoon Kim, we started to theorize how could I, as a humanist, make my own AI to solve my own problems. And we came up with this software that we nicknamed Moon, or Ren in Chinese. It makes it so that I, as a humanist, can really collect my data that I really care about and have big data. And then I can attach it to different kinds of algorithms to model that data so that I can have solutions for my problems. And then if I want to, I can share those solutions with friends and colleagues and other people in my field. And of course, we started with my books of poems because those are the ones I really care about. So you would drop an image into the system. I would label it, telling the computer, this is a character that means this, and so on and so forth. I would do that several times. I would click one or two more buttons. And then afterwards, I would put in another picture, and the machine would give me a transcription. Hallelujah. With all the old scripts and all of the funny characters and everything that most systems can't do. A friend from in Buddhist studies asked if I could do this for the Chisha Canon, which is this enormous canon, enormous text of Buddhist sutras and other kinds of Buddhist wisdom, 120,000 pages, 10 million Chinese characters, and me and Song Hoon sat down, and yes, we could transcribe it with our colleagues in Taiwan and build something that they could have a complete and very accurate transcription of their entire Buddhist canon, one of them anyways. And then colleagues from the National Library got onto this and said, hey, well, what about us? And I said, sure. And what they wanted me to do was take 90,000 images of rare Korean periodicals and find the colophones. This is the sort of thing at the end of the book that tells you who published it and when and these kinds of things. Can you find those colophones, transcribe them, and give that back to us so that we can use it as part of our metadata? And I said, well, we'll try. And same process, yes, we can teach the computer to find this thing called a colophone. We can transcribe what's on the colophone and export text that enhances the library's metadata. And at the same time for me, and this is really the important part, the deep learning, the encoding, all that pattern recognition enhances my own deep learning as a scholar. I discovered 100 publishing and printing shops that I had never heard of before. It just opened up this huge world. I could understand this print shop as opposed to another one. I could get deep into the different typographical things that were going on in early 20th century Korea and shaping my poets in this world that they were working in. And then business came knocking. People who were working and were vendors for the National Library of Korea said, we want your software. How much does it cost? And I thought, let me think about that. but we figured out a price, and a company was born out of all this, Tamil Vista Insights. The idea of making it so that people can create their own AI. And here goes the switch of my hat from sort of humanist to sort of business person, because I'm going to pitch you. The problem these days is that big tech monopolizes the power to make AI. And what we have, what I found, is that we have a solution that empowers people to make their own AI for their own problems. You can find your own data. You're the expert. You curate that data. We help you attach it to some algorithms with a couple clicks, and then you can model that data so you can answer your questions. The opportunity, the business opportunity, is actually tremendous. I think it's analogous to what we had with the mainframe computer age and when the personal computer came along. All of a sudden, computation was put into the hands of everybody. And we think of cloud, we think of AI as something that comes to us from the cloud, but actually we can make it so that I can actually do it right here on this laptop, in this room, not connected to any cloud. If we think about this idea of an AI authoring software and think about other kinds of office suites and things like this, the market is already proven. It's tremendously, it's huge. It's beyond anything I can imagine anyways. And if we do the work of trying to figure out what kinds of people might need this kind of technology in Asia, the market is similarly enormous. And yes, we're going to be raising money. So any investors in the room, come see me. But this is not entirely the point. The point is that there's a business that has grown out of a deep and sort of fascination and need to read things like poems. And that by going this business route, I have the opportunity to at least try to democratize access to the power of artificial intelligence by putting it into the hands of individuals, into people's hands. And we can also begin to address some of these representational inequalities, inequities that we have in our evolving historical record. And best of all, if this business really goes, I get to go back to my poems. And in fact, I can keep reading my poems as I build this, because as I build these new technologies, this opens up all new realms for my humanistic learning. It takes me back to my sort of secret public lives of poems. And so what I want to close with is the idea that I'm not suggesting business people have to become humanists or that humanists need to become business people. No. The aim here is to suggest that they can be. Deep learning and the humanities can serve humanistic ends, and the ends it serves in the humanities can also present business opportunities. We can say to potential humanities students, we can teach you what's missing, what's lacking from the news. We can tell you how to find it in the everyday hustle of commerce. That deep satisfaction that comes from learning, even if what you want to learn is only of interest to you and a few friends, like my Korean poems. In the same breath, we can say that just like learning in business and the sciences, learning in the humanities holds the promise of material wealth in addition to a lifetime of satisfaction that comes from knowing how to read a poem and contemplating history. Thank you very much.